You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Early in Catherine Lacey's novel called Nobody Is Ever Missing, Elyria Riley, a 28-year-old protagonist, secretly buys a one-way ticket to New Zealand and leaves her Manhattan apartment, her job as a soap opera scriptwriter, and her husband behind without a word of explanation. She spends the next few months hitchhiking across New Zealand, working odd jobs and sleeping in public parks, all the while trying to make sense of herself and her life. Catherine Lacey, who received a New York Foundation for the Arts Artist Fellowship in Fiction Writing, has published stories in Granta and McSweeney's and nonfiction in The Atlantic and The Paris Review. This is her debut novel. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In his rave review in the July 3rd Wall Street Journal, Sam Sachs called your book, quote, a serious, frequently brilliant novel with a sustained intensity that is rare in fiction. And he added that it was the most promising first novel he'd encountered this year. I assume you were pleased.
Yeah, that was sort of exciting and random and new.
How long had you been working on the book?
It was about a year of full-time work on the book, and then I took some time off to do a revision, gutted it. It was about twice as long at one point.
You gutted it. What'd you take out?
A lot of repetitive stuff that didn't need to be there.
Years ago, I'm trying to remember, was it William Styron, was asked about how much he'd taken out of a book, any really interesting chapters, any interesting stories. He said, no, just adjectives and adverbs. You've said that when you first started writing this, you didn't even want to call it a novel because you were afraid that you'd jinx it. What did you call it for yourself?
I was working on a nonfiction book that ended up getting shelved, and I was just sort of playing with fiction on the side, and this character kept coming back. I didn't really have a name for her, and I was just writing lots of short fiction. So it was just a series of stories that kind of kept getting bigger and talking to each other.
So this is a short story collection that wound up becoming a novel.
I don't even know if I would have called it a short story collection. It was more like distraction and procrastination from something else I should have been doing.
Some of our listeners may already be familiar with your name from an essay you wrote in the New York Times on April 19th about co-owning and operating a Brooklyn bed and breakfast with a group of other artists. Were you part of the original group that created the B&B 3B?
Yes.
Can you tell us about it, the people who missed that New York Times story?
Yeah. So in 2010, I was thinking about moving away from New York, and I moved in on a sublet to this amazing co-op home that really charmed me in a way that I didn't think that living with seven people necessarily would.
Are they all writers?
No. It kind of got framed as a bunch of artists, and everybody is creative in some way, but I'm still the only writer there, but we have people that play music and make pottery and weaving and all sorts of things.
And its goal is to provide you and the other artists with a place to live and to give you time to pursue careers in the arts?
Mainly just to, like, live happily and affordably in Brooklyn. Not everybody has an arts career. So, like, half of us do. Other people just want to, you know, live affordably here, and that's really difficult. So we all work about part-time. We all work about 10 hours a week in the B&B, and that pays for our rent and utilities, which are pretty inexpensive because we share so much.
Although part of this novel is set in Manhattan, most of it takes place in New Zealand. Have you spent much time in New Zealand?
Yeah, I went there for 3 months in 2010.
Elyria flies there on what almost seems to be a whim. Does she have much of a plan other than to stay in a spare room in a farmhouse owned by Werner, a writer she'd only met once at a cocktail party?
She doesn't have much of a plan at all, no. Mainly, I think the appeal of New Zealand is that it's extremely far away, and she thinks she won't be found there.
Has she let Werner know she's coming?
No.
does she have any idea what she's going to do when she's in New Zealand other than gawk at the beauty of the place?
I think she just wants the opposite of what her life is in New York at that moment.
And Werner expects her to be using her time there to write, but she says she doesn't want to write the great American novel or any novel. In fact, she had been writing soap operas. She was perfectly happy writing soap operas.
I don't know if she's perfectly happy doing anything, but she did sort of stumble into a career writing for a soap opera.
You've written this book in the first person from Illyria's point of view and almost a stream of consciousness style. Did you know from the start that that's how you wanted to tell the story?
Yeah, I don't, there's not much of the appeal. I don't have much interest in the third person voice, writing, and even now, like, I'm less interested in reading it.
Well, one reviewer, a blogger, called Illyria the ultimate unreliable narrator. Is that how you see her?
I don't see her that way at all. I think that she's, I find her quite reliable, actually. She's just maybe not giving you a ton of plot, but I think what she's talking about from the way that she talks about her feelings is extremely reliable, maybe too reliable.
Because she's a troubled soul.
Yeah.
She can be very insightful and very funny, but maybe you'll read a little bit of the opening for us to give us a sense of her voice.
All right. I'll just read from chapter one.
A couple of pages.
Okay.
Or page, maybe, I don't know, until it seems reasonable to stop.
Okay. There might be people in this world who can read minds against their will, and if that kind of person exists, I'm pretty sure my husband is one of them. I think this because of what happened the week I knew I'd be leaving soon, but he didn't know. I knew I needed to tell him first, but I couldn't imagine any possible way to get my mouth to make those words. And since my husband can unintentionally read minds, he drank a good deal more than usual that week, jars of gin mostly, but tall beers from the deli, too. He'd walk in sipping a can hidden in a paper bag, smile like it was a joke. I would laugh. He would laugh. Inside our laughing, we weren't really laughing. The morning I left, he got out of bed, got dressed, and left the room. I stayed cold awake under shut lids until I heard our front door close. I left the apartment at noon, wearing my backpack, and I felt so sick and absurd that I walked into a bar instead of the subway. I ordered a double bourbon, even though I don't usually drink like that, and the bartender asked me where I was from, and I said Germany for no good reason, or maybe just so he wouldn't try and talk to me, or maybe because I needed to live in some other story for a half hour. I was a lone German woman, here to see the Statue of Liberty and the Square of Time and the Park of Central. Not a woman taking a one-way flight to a country where she only knew one person who had only once extended an offer of his guest room, which, when she thought of it again, seemed to be the kind of invitation a person extends when they know it won't be taken. But now it was too late because I was taking it, and oh well, oh well, oh well. A man took the stool beside me, despite a long row of empties, ordered a cranberry and nothing. "What's your trouble?" he asked me. "Tell me your trouble, baby." I looked back at him like I didn't have any trouble to tell, because that's my trouble, I thought, not knowing how to tell it. And this is why my favorite thing about airport security is how you can cry the whole way through, and they'll only try and figure out whether or not you'll blow up. They'll still search you if they want to search you. They'll still try and detect metal in you. They'll still yell about laptops and liquids and gels and shoes, and no one will ask what's wrong because everything is already wrong. And they won't look twice at you because they're only paid to look once. And for this, sometimes, some people are thankful.
Catherine Lacey reading from her new novel called Nobody Is Ever Missing. Illyria met the man who became her husband at a police station immediately after her sister killed herself. You don't reveal his name until the end of the book. Earlier in the novel, as we just heard, Illyria refers to him only as husband, mm-hmm. Kind of impersonal.
Yeah.
Why had she been drawn to him at first, if she seems to have so little connection with him?
Oh, I think they bonded through trauma at a certain period in their life. His mother had committed suicide 10 years before when he was about her age. And I think that the trauma that the suicide of her sister brought up for him and what she was going through just immediately bonded them in a way.
But then their marriage isn't all that close or happy.
I don't think they grew from that. You know, like that's sort of, it's kind of a portrait of how strong trauma can bond people together, but also how limiting that can be.
Does she see him as a nasty person?
No, I think they just don't know how to take care of each other and they don't talk, so.
Well, he cancels her credit cards right after she leaves and then later tells customs officials in New Zealand that she's crazy and maybe a danger to herself or others.
Yeah.
A bit extreme, although it's understandable that mm-hmm. he'd be angry the way she left.
Yeah, exactly.
You leave the questions about how sane Illyria really is open, although her mental state seems to deteriorate over the course of the book. She seems to be increasingly bothered by what she calls a wildebeest inside her. Should we assume that the wildebeest represents the anger she feels toward her husband, or maybe toward life in general?
Definitely, although I don't think that she's necessarily needs to be diagnosed, and I think that the wildebeest or the trauma and the sadness that she carries with her is something that everyone has in some quantity in them. I think hers goes unchecked and isn't taken care of in any way. So in some ways, it's just sort of a portrait of something that's inside of everyone.
Oh, never sure whether Illyria wants to find herself or is trying to escape from herself.
Yeah, I don't think that finding herself is... I mean, that's sort of the language that we have around a person going on a trip like this by themselves. But I don't think that there's any part of her that's thinks she's going to go find herself or discover something new.
You've created a lot of really funny characters for this book, including Illyria's mother, who is decidedly unmaternal. Mm. Can we trace some of the trouble that Illyria seems to be having through to the people that should have helped her along the way?
Sure, yeah. I mean, she didn't grow up with a lot of maternal care or paternal care. And I mean, I did that sort of on purpose, just to kind of have someone that didn't have any ability to take care of herself or any kind of examples of someone that could take care of themselves.
What does Illyria's mother think about her daughter's decision to leave her husband and travel alone around New Zealand?
I guess that never really gets revealed. She is sort of ambivalent about it. She just sort of is like, oh, that's just typical you. That's just the kind of things that you do. And I think when you have a person, when someone has people in their lives that tell them that oh, that's just typical you, that's just what you do, you never grow or progress from that. And that's definitely what she's going through.
You've written short stories. You've written nonfiction, now a novel. But like Illyria, have you ever written soap operas?
No. I actually don't know anything about soap operas. I don't know really where that came from. It just sort of seemed to make sense with...
Would you want to write them?
No, I have no desire to.
Because they're kind of like writing strings of short stories.
Well, everything's just so extreme that there's no, you know, there's no like nuance in a soap opera. So I guess that's why it sort of fit with her. There's no nuance. There's no subtlety.
One more thing. You mentioned possums frequently in this novel. Are there really as many possums in New Zealand as you've described?
Possums are a huge problem in New Zealand.
Because a number have been spotted in Brooklyn.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In fact, it's I just read a newspaper article about that. I'm wondering whether we should be concerned.
Well, I don't know. I haven't looked into that. But the possums in New Zealand really are a menace to the natural vegetation there. I mean, I was working on farms, and everyone that I work for was very concerned about trying to get rid of possums. Or one woman told me that if I could figure out a way to control the possum population in New Zealand, that she was like, you would be a millionaire overnight.
He might be prime minister of New Zealand.
Yeah.
Well, they also threaten pets, don't they? They're scarier than raccoons.
Yeah, they are pretty scary little critters.
I'm assuming you're working on another non-novel?
I am working on something. We'll see what it is. Yeah.
Catherine Lacey's novel, Nobody Is Ever Missing, is available from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me.